Hi, my name is Robert Higgins.
And hi, I guess I'm Kate Tuxford.
And I guess this is episode 125 of Screenwriting from the Trenches, a podcast about the craft and expression of screenwriting in all of its forms, I guess, from the perspective of writers just like you.
This week, because Hollywood is slacking, we are discussing show, don't goddamn tell. The only rule screenwriting can agree in screenwriting everyone can agree on. But first, we have to discuss as usual all of the hullabaloo that screenwriting Twitter was a Twitter about this week. Take it away, Zach.
It's just another day in screenwriting drama, screenwriting drama, screenwriting drama. It's just another day in screenwriting drama. It's another day in screenwriting drama.
I gotta add one here just because speaking of Twitter. Elon Musk continues to get trolled by Stephen King, who Elon Musk is pleading everyone to call it X. And Stephen King responded back going, Twitter, 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 Twitter. And it's delicious, especially he is a transphobe and won't refer to his trans daughter by their chosen name. We'll only call them their birth name. So I really enjoy dead naming a transphobe's app.
Well,
I
yeah,
love it.
but he also got into it with Stephen King, and when Stephen King said Twitter, he said, "Please stop dead naming this app," which was highly ironic. And I
Highly.
remember, yeah, I saw it, and I was just like, "That is wow, that is so ironic." Like you have to, oh God, that's one of those things where you're just like. If irony were a real thing, like if it was like a physical thing, if it could just show up, if there was like a matter force of irony, like it would show up to certain people and just be like, get out. Just kick people out of the universe, I feel like. Because they're like, I'm just like, you have no awareness, you have no respect for what I do, so I'm kicking you out of existence. I can't take it. It's painful with you around.
You are not a serious person.
Yeah. Just awful. Speaking of awful, Nick Pizzolatto is Pizzolatto. Pizzolatto. I can't say his name. The guy who the showrunner or the former showrunner of True Detective and executive producer.
And is the sourest of grapes.
Yes.
I feel like he and Taylor Sheridan hang out and talk about how nobody understands them.
He is this week's Twitter villain of the week. Him, I feel like he's sharing that with studios right now. Like there's the studios
And maybe
in,
Tyler Perry coming up.
yeah, I don't know, he's working on it, but the good Lord, there the oh God, he started this whole thing started on Instagram but bled over into Twitter where the writers are, where Nick was, I said to say Nick, but the showrunner was not retweeting, but he was reposting people's dissatisfaction, their reviews with True Detective season four.
No, because he was not the showrunner.
Right. He was not the showrunner. Right. Sidebar,
He, yeah.
apparently True Detective season four just got renewed for season five
With
because
the
it was
same
the
showrunner.
highest, huh? With the
With
same
this, with,
showrunner, Issa Lopez.
and so obviously he created the show. He got to be showrunner for the first couple seasons. It was going downhill, and
Yeah, it's
so
Issa Lopez.
for season four, Night Country, they decided, or decisions were made that Issa Lopez would showrun it. And this has been like a, I would argue, like I think of the biggest pickup interest in True Detective since the first season. But I think Colosso is being sour grapes because he is retweeting all the negative reviews. So it's like he wants it all to be a failure, which is just really like it's petty.
It's really petty. It's honestly, and he's an executive producer, I guess, listed for season four. So he's still getting paid for not doing any work,
And then it's
essentially.
not like they're writing him out of anything. He gets paid every episode because he created this.
So he's still getting paid for the show, even though he did no work. And he couldn't even be gracious and just be like, hey, I have nothing to do. If he'd just been like that, hey, I have nothing to do with season four, love it or hate it. All awards or, barbs go to Issa Lopez. I have nothing but love and respect for the team, blah, blah, blah. That's it. That's all he had to say. That's all he had to say. But no, he had to go renegade. And apparently he was just like, I don't like the thing the ladies did on my show. And you just went all, whatever. And so most of Twitter seemed to find it petty, with the people who didn't find it petty, you sort of feel like they're one of those people that would be like, release the Snyder Cut type fuck.
I was thinking about this because since True Detective came out, Carrie Funkanawa got essentially canceled because of his inappropriate conduct on projects where he's basically sleeping with extras and anybody like and telling women like, oh, I'll help you on your next show or I'll help you and then or turning it into a business, from what appears to be a business deal to definitely like a hookup. And so you kind of wonder how healthy that first season was. And maybe it was okay, but if Nick and Carrie were getting along and feeling like season one was like their everything, I just kind of wonder if that's part of why, they moved on, because it may have been a little bit more toxic of a set than we knew at the time. I don't know, that's just conjecture because I don't have any information. The stuff about Funkanawa is out there. I can bring the receipts on that. I don't have anything about what it was like with those two working together,
I know.
but
I just For me, this just it seems it's so unnecessary. Like, for me, if I'm getting a check, even if I don't less necessarily like it, my work is out there and speaks for itself. So I don't, maybe he felt some kind of way, like he had a take, and the studio was like, we're gonna go in a different direction this year. So sorry, too bad. And we like this, and apparently it worked for them because this is the highest, not only the highest rated since season one, but it's also the highest numbers that they've had since season one. And so it just got picked up for season five with the same showrunner from season four. So, they
That
won that
yeah, at the
round.
end of the
You know what I
day, you
mean?
gotta look at the numbers, and the numbers are there saying people like it. And I haven't seen it yet, so I don't have an opinion on the story, but I did notice it was a little dividing between there are stronger female characters in this one compared to season one, and there was a lot more response on the acting from the women in this. So I wonder if, that's part of that sense of like, oh, it was originally two guys driving around talking about time being a flat circle, and now it feels like it got taken over by the women's, like kind of feels like there's some subtext there.
Yeah, that seems to be the there was a really nasty meme going around post Madam Web, because this sort of goes into the other villain of the week, where studios apparently what they learned from making a bad movie with Madam Web was that we need to make less movies with women. That was like that was their lesson. They're like, okay, so we made a shit movie. All right, what did we take from this? Movies with women don't work. Yes, that's clearly true. Like, it's not like Barbie made a ton of money. Yes, you're right. That didn't happen. You know what I mean? It wasn't like the
Every time
last.
there's a movie with a woman in it, they're always like, it's a fluke. It's a
Right.
fluke. And then
It's
oh,
not,
we
though.
have asked Madame Web. We barely asked Madame Web, and nobody saw it. So it's the women that are the problem. Or it
Right.
was the same
And
problem with the Marvels, which I think isn't a perfect Marvel movie, but it definitely is better than others. And so like it definitely didn't deserve that hate. There definitely was some of that was misogyny inspired. You've seen it.
I have very spicy thoughts about the Marvels that I don't want to get into right here and stuff like that. That movie feels like that. It feels like a it, unlike other movies that feel like, it'd be like somewhere in there is a good movie. This feels like a good movie that was chopped to death, but at least in terms of the Marvels. When I look at the Marvels, I'm like, this was a good movie that got studioed to death. Whereas you look at something like Madame Web and you're like, this is a movie that the studio know what the fuck they were doing. Just if it got so bad that even lay people were seeing the cracks in your craft, then it's bad. That's not something that is, you know, that no, that's terrible kind of stuff that you can't really fix. Like you didn't even try. But anyway, it certainly had nothing to do with women. And then trying to paint it as if only female superhero movies don't make money. Looking at you, Green Lantern. You know what I mean? Like or the X-Men movies. How
Or
many of those
Black
have
Adam.
flopped? You know what I mean? Come on. It's not. No, stop it. Stop it.
Agreed, agreed.
So just they made a bad movie, and Sony, as we discussed last week, cannot handle their properties, especially their Spider-Man properties.
They're
They
going through an
cannot,
identity crisis.
right? They can't handle their own shit. So it's not that women are the problem, it's that movies written badly and radically changed according to Dakota Johnson in terms of the script in what seems like production and post. Where you know you had actors sign on, they were like, okay, this is decent. They came on, they were like, what is this? And this happens all the time. We talked about this last year where they were talking about how, and I didn't even know that this was a thing, but I should have known, where like they'll do full passes to get actors to sign on and then just change the script. I remember they were talking about the Halle Berry pass of the Storm, but had all these awesome scenes. Matthew Vaughn saw was just like, what is this? And they were like, oh, this is the Halle Berry pass. We just wanted to get her to sign on. We're gonna change it. He's just like, what the fuck is this? This is great stuff. They're just like, yeah, we're not, none of this is gonna be in the movie. So you
Yeah,
know what I mean?
exactly.
Just absolute insanity. And that's the kind of stuff that happens, apparently. Somebody must have done a Dakota Johnson pass. Well, madam, what? She signed up. And then they came and she's like, what the fuck is this? What is this? And they were like, this is the movie. Anyway. So yeah. Anyway, the speaking of studios being the villain, continuing to be the villain, there's no pilots this year, apparently.
Three. They're filming
Right,
three.
there's three pilots. They're all at NBC. But out of all of the networks, only three pilots are getting new pilots are getting made this year, and all of them are at the same network, which is a bit of a downturn.
Listen, when I first went to like got out of school, we were in this new streaming bubble, and it was everywhere. It was a new show, a new show, a new show, you know. And now the bubble is bursting, especially now with where the state of the industry is. And these places are realizing either one, they don't have the capital to like make 100 pilots and pick out their favorites every year. Like they literally, that's what they used to do. And two, they're struggling just to keep some of their shows on the air. There's been so many cancellations, and the people who are running it are looking at the bottom line. They're not looking at what content do we need. You know, I think NBC has been around long enough, they know they need something. Something's got to go through, especially because they are network and they have some obligations and contracts. You know, unlike streaming, they don't have that necessarily. Like Netflix could decide next year not to make anything, and Netflix would be, you know, I don't know if the subscribers would change, but NBC doesn't have content on there, then they lose their advertisers instantly because they're like, oh, I don't
Right.
want to be on a rerun of this show. I want to be on the new show, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think they have a little bit more of an impetus, but three is dismal. I've never seen it be this low.
Yeah, that's and it's really weird because you would think sort of the leading the charge for the last few years has been either NBC or CBS. And CBS is their bread and butter is those Chuck Lorre style sitcoms, and for them not to have any in the pipeline is just strange, you know. Like, but it is a symbol of the industry being where it's going, like everybody sort of pulling back and making safe choices. I'm chomping at the bit because, as much as I think this is bad, and it is bad for the industry, I know where it's going because you can already see what's happening and stuff like that. And we did that whole section last year at the end of last year on independent television. And you can see it happening. And once these studios realize where they're just vendors, who can pick up things that don't cost them, but that don't have the overhead, where they don't have to worry about sets or, holding on to things from year to year to year in studio space. All that overhead goes away, and you can have people doing that kind of stuff. It's just, and the technology is coming down. I'm telling y'all, it's coming, but that's, I don't want to get into a long rant on that. I'm just saying, this is just the beginning.
Yeah, it's something we've been kind of circling the last couple of podcasts, which is like the new state of the industry is if the studio is acting more like a distributor and not the manufacturer, then independent is going to be, I mean, if they're not willing to put the energy into something, they're going to be looking elsewhere for content to like for proof of concept or make sure like, oh, everybody already likes this, we'll come and take it. It happens in the publishing world a little bit too, where like an independent bookseller will be like, oh, I sold 50,000 copies of this book on my own. And then, Penguin or Random House is like, oh, I guess we could make money off of you.
Right,
So,
exactly.
it definitely is a method in business that happens. Question is obviously like indie TV, it only allows a breeding ground for, I'd say, like low budget TV or lower budget TV. We're not shooting $1 million sci-fi episodes usually until we get enough indie companies that have that sort of capital or deal, but
Well,
like
I
Netflix
mean,
that could like out that money like nothing.
I don't know, Kentucky, because our next thing is Tyler Perry with,
That's
where
true.
with this new product that got released by the makers of ChatGPT. What is it called? Sonora or
Sonora.
Sonora? Yeah, Sonora got revealed.
Sonora, more like Snora. Yeah.
It got revealed this week, and I still haven't seen the video. I've only seen the screenshots. But they did this demo where they were like, if you type in astronauts that wear red wool knitted caps, though on a snow planet, did, like, you know what I mean? Like, they put in all these prompts and stuff like that, and then it generated this trailer for a movie about these astronauts with red snow knitted caps. You know what I mean? Like, it was the whole thing, and people were like, oh, we're all gonna lose our jobs. And Tyler Perry came on and said that he had halted an $800 million expansion onto Tyler Perry Studios, where because he said that this product was basically going to be able to
Do all the
keep,
work.
yeah,
Yeah.
like keep him from having to spend that money, but basically by being able to create these virtual sets. And Tyler Perry is famous for, shooting whole shows in a day and just taking things down. I mean, y'all know me. I think of myself as one of the like a true believer in terms of indie film, but Tyler Perry gives that kind of shit a bad name. Just the
He
burnt out actors and stuff like that, the way that they treat people, like you can't, you know what I mean? But this is the kind of stuff that makes, and he was trying to talk out of both sides of his mouth, where he's just like, we gotta put the brakes on this. At the same time, he's halting his expansion because he's like, well, I don't have to worry about that shit anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't,
Yeah.
I, you know.
And this is not the first time Tyler Perry's come up recently. He came up as one of the people that was not paying his crews and stuff during the strike. A lot of them were on subsidies and things like that, part of the film funds. And he's just it's hard in the world of indie film because there's this element of like, oh, we look out for the little guy and nurture our projects, and then somebody like him is also in that feel kind of grinding and grinding and grinding down to the like the most essential, whatever he can get away with. So I'm not surprised that that he's gonna wait and see if he can make more bank off of it. I think all of us are kind of going, oh fuck, what is AI going to do? And I think I still say at the end of the day, there's a lot of things that AI can't do. And really, where it's most useful at this point is like management skill. But even then, ChatGPT had like a a complete split personality disorder this week and was speaking in between English and some sort of Spanglish, not even Spanish, but Spanglish. So, it's just a reminder that everybody is putting all their eggs in this basket, and you could really quickly run into quite a problem where you have something, that isn't going to serve you the way you think it is.
What's crazy about AI is the rush to push out creatives who literally we watch movies and read books and consume art and entertainment to see the perspective of people who are like us. And we this is the thing, like as we see like Hollywood, people are saying that like Hollywood is stale, Hollywood is boring, we're not getting roles that challenge us, things like that. The reason is because people are playing it safe with their art when the stuff that makes money is the stuff that's bold.
Yeah.
Like the things that the everything everywhere all at once is. You know what I mean? That movie is not necessarily, I don't want to say it's rough, but it's not necessarily as polished as a lot of, it's certainly not a Marvel's, you know what I mean? It doesn't have the slick nature of, as you're speaking of a movie that has like a lot of like martial arts and fight sequences and things and stuff like that. There's no sort of there's a roughness to it
Yeah.
and just sort of homegrown feeling to it that spoke to people. People wanted that. And the special effects were sort of hand done. You know what I mean? People wanted the weird stuff. They wanted the handmade stuff. And
Yeah, and I think it did blend to its like voice of like, it is some of this is over the top and ridiculous, and the Daniels kind of like part of their style is they always just own it. Like
right.
they don't want it. I mean, they're not, if you look at any of their material, they don't aspire to make something smooth and studio and polished. They like the paint, the brush strokes, and for us to occasionally be like, oh, this
Right.
is movie magic, which is I think is a reason why their movie stood out, because that run of AI is a kind of a race to mediocrity,
Right.
or at
Right.
least having the same look and vibe and style as everyone else.
It just because it's only because it can only spit out versions of things that we've already done before. So it's like the remix machine, you know what I mean? That only works when you're hitting shuffle on a playlist. I don't want it to spit out a movie for me. You know what I mean? Like I want a perspective. I want something that's going to make me feel something. I want something that someone's, put their blood, sweat, and tears into. And when people talk about things like Madame Web and like why it didn't make any money, is because when people look at that, they're like, I'm not taking anything away from this. There's nothing in there, even out of the Boom Boom Crash stuff. Like, the reason why we sort of lampooned it to death, but the reason why those Fast and the Furious movies were they were in such a high, you know what I mean, for like three
Right.
or four movies, was because the family element finally came together in movie five. Like when that family element came to it and people are like, oh yeah, like I have an uncle who lives like this, you know what I mean? They were taking things from it. And it was largely based on Vin Diesel and Paul Walker, God rest him. And people could tell that that seemed to be a real friendship in real life. A lot of that was just sort of based on that the cast seemed to genuinely enjoy each other. And people were just like, that took you, it was the same thing when they did those Ocean's 11 movies. They were
Yeah.
like, these people genuinely seem to be like hanging out and have a good time. As long as there's a good script, we're it. Fantastic. Just go for it. And that those things, like people just they're feeling something because they're just like, look, I get something out of that. I feel something when I watch this. You're not gonna get the same thing from having like the remix machine just spin around and hit a bunch of stuff that you don't like. It's
Yeah.
already like that.
Yeah, I mean,
What?
like if you look at Disney, they're taking stuff like Little Mermaid and doing a remix machine on it, and it's not yielding the numbers or the type of audience appeal And you know, you can again look at some people are like, that's because the Little Mermaid now is black. And I'm like, that's not it. It's the same freaking story we already saw, you
Right.
know, and everybody goes, oh, I want it to be a little bit different. That's why I think Cruella did a lot better for them because Cruella was a different storyline. Everything was a prequel before 101 Dalmatians. It was new content. It was
Right.
still using IP, but it, you know, when you have somebody like Tommy McNamara from The Great, you know, spinning it and going dark and talking about killing puppies. Suddenly we're like, yeah, no, I think this thing has some thoughts. And I think this remix, as we've seen from all these Disney live actions, is I think there was a part of them that thought, oh, we have all these scripts, we know everything that works, everything will be good for development. We'll just do it again for cheaper, right? And what they found is that like the audiences aren't there for it.
Well, even like
Overall, yeah.
the biggest, I think, example of this is Barbie, biggest
Yes.
film of last year. What are the, just off the dome, what would you think would be the comps for Barbie?
That's a good one. It does lean a little too. I'm just trying to think of comps where, like, I mean, it's that I don't have any great comps.
Right. That's my point. I don't either. And that's the point that I want to make right there. Somebody took a movie that doesn't that from what you're looking at, you're like, this movie doesn't have any great comps. It is a comp now. Now it itself is a comp. People say it's Barbie meets this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's the type of movie that people seem to want. They want movies that don't necessarily have comps. When you make AI movies, they're nothing but comps. It's just the comps remix. There's nothing about them that's original or is going to make people feel anything. And so that if you're trying to take a lesson from what the industry is telling you that it wants very desperately, it's
Yeah.
stuff that has no comps. The Infinity Saga, in terms of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, had no comps. There had been nothing that came before it, like an interconnected, like comic book world, sort of Star Trek, but it wasn't like you wouldn't use the like
Or
Star
Star
Trek. And,
Wars, yeah.
yeah, you wouldn't use either of those as comps for the MCU. Like,
No,
you know.
because basically it's had all these interconnected movies separate that all built to one culmination point.
The thing about those movies is not only did they had no cost, but they were well written and
Yes.
they looked like
And
they
they
had
were
been
shot
spent,
well.
right? They were shot well. They had voices behind them. Marcus and McFeely, they're a god tier in terms of that stuff. You know what I mean? They paid off the stories. If somebody was paying attention.
All the characters had time to discover their character in previous movies. So by the time they were there, they knew their character, they knew what they wanted, they knew how they worked in the team or what part of it. And so, like, you know, think of something like Iron Man. If we hadn't had all these Iron Man movies before we get to, you know, Infinity War and Endgame, there'd be no satisfying payoff. You
Right,
know, it'd be like,
100%.
oh, the douchey guy sacrificed himself. Because,
Right.
you know, crossing over with Tom Holland, Spider-Man, where there's a bit of a mentor-mentee relationship, we wouldn't have felt it. It took 10 movies to build up to this feeling.
Right. It took its time
Yeah.
and it showed it had clear craft and care and story behind it. That's the juice. That's the lesson you're supposed to take away. It's that people want you to take your time. They want you to slow the fuck down. They want you to make something that's going to make them feel something. They want it to be weird. They want it to be odd. But if you have a movie about a talking raccoon who is paired up with a talking tree who only says three words, and that movie got two sequels and several specials.
And a holiday special, which is amazing.
Right? Like everybody thought that movie was going to fall on its face. But because there's a genuine story about a family of misfits coming together, it makes you feel something. It's weird. They picked James Gunn, of all people, you know, to make that movie at the time. You know, he wasn't the
And
James
James
Gunn that
Gunn
he is
said,
now.
I'm ready, let's
Right.
go.
And so, you know, you picked the director of Slither to make that movie. You know what I mean? And that was where they went, and it worked. It's great. It's weird. It's out there. It's a strange little film. And Marvel was just like, we're gonna go. We're gonna kick the tires. And they did it. And that's the kind of stuff people want. They want those kind of big swings. And if you're not gonna like I said, we continue to go into this all the time, but like bottom line is nobody wants the remix machine. Nobody wants it. You're taking the wrong lesson. And even if you think it's gonna make you more money because it's gonna be cheaper, you're gonna make stuff cheaper, you're not gonna make any money because nobody wants to see it.
I'll agree on that.
So speaking of showing, not telling. This is
Yes.
our topic for today. The reason I wanted to explore this is because there was a scene that was released from the remake of a beloved children's television show this week that shall remain nameless. And they put this scene out of where you had all of these characters talking, and it was just over the shoulder shot, coverage, 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 coverage. And it was just characters. Just I was like, who blocked this? Like, it feels like one of those, like, I don't know. Maybe they were under the gun. They had a long day. I don't know what happened on set, but it was just characters standing, and just the camera would pop on one, they would pop on the other one, and they just talk through the exposition. And I was just like, this has none of the energy of the original source material. This is the scene that you want to champion what the show is like. And I was just like, this, and these people, whenever you're dealing with Hollywood, no matter what, you're always dealing with people who are at the top of their craft. So I'm looking at this and I'm just like, who, why? Would, because there's a character in the scene who is a villain, one of the biggest villains of the series. And one of the ways that you show a villain or show that this person has a power is how you portray them on camera. But yet I was watching this scene and I'm watching the actors, all of the actors are being shot at the same level. There's no sort of sense of thing. And this is camera stuff, I know, but it was just like, this is also in the script where it is clearly like nothing. There's the characters aren't reacting to her in a way that would show you that like this person is a monster. Maybe they changed it. I don't know. But I'm just like, in the show, this person is an absolute monster. And I know who this is. So I'm just like, I'm not understanding it. And if it's not that, I don't necessarily know that I want to watch it because I'm like, I already got the better version of this then. Because this just doesn't look good. But there's other stuff that I've seen recently where I'm just like, this is just the exposition of something where I watched a really good version of it when I was watching The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which I've discovered recently is my favorite movie of all time. And there's, yeah. And so as I'm watching this, there's a scene where Daniel Craig's Mikael Blomkvist is. He is going through all of the old notes of the case, of the Harriet case. And as he's going through and highlighting it, instead of having us read what's on these notes, they just show it to us. They just give it to us. They're like, the police were here. They went here. They did this.
And
And
you
you're
cut to them doing those things, right?
right. It's very simple, but it's just like, oh, that's so inventive. Instead of just, and there's really no dialogue outside of like, you know, what is going on, but they're showing, not telling. It would be very easy for them to just be like to go through like him doing a scene with the police officer and telling him what they did and how they investigated and they still found nothing. But instead of that, instead of having like, and they've had it seen before where they could have gone into that exposition, and instead they want to tell you something about the characters that's going to lead to the later set up some payoffs. But this scene is where they do that. They take all that gooky exposition of like, how did this investigation play out the first hand? And they just show it to you. And I'm like, that's a great example of show, don't fucking tell. Just like, and so, you know.
Let's back up Because I think we've got people on here who are, I mean, some of the folk listening are seasoned, we're pretty seasoned, but then there are also people who are listening and they're working on their first script, and maybe this is the first time they're getting this note or coming across it. And I first of all, I want to say something, which is, I think if you're a writer and you're getting your work evaluated, this is a really common note to get as a new writer, or maybe as a seasoned writer, but maybe you're rushing through something. So it's evergreen. It may show up at any point in your career, but usually early in your career is when I see it come up the most. And so I just want to put that out there as well for our folks listening. You may have just started getting this note and you're wondering, what the heck do I do with this? And so Rob, your reaction is right towards that show, I think, unless I change the story. But I want to like just get into the basics of what is show versus tell, because I think we can build up from there. Because when that note comes across, basically you're explaining something in the narrative or through dialogue, but we don't get to see it. We don't get to be a part of that experience. So, for example, it could be somebody says something along the lines of, you know how my aunt is a bank robber? And they go, yeah, we talked about that last time, and then move on. And you go, well, geez, man, what? I can't see the aunt robbing banks and then realize she calls him on the way out and it's just like, I'll be there for your birthday, nephew. Like, what? I would rather see that scene and know to learn how Ant is a bank robber than just be like, remember how? Yeah.
I think when we're first starting out as writers, we're either, we're trying to think of it like, everything like action lines and things like that, everything feels sort of secondary to the dialogue. And so we put a lot of stuff in the dialogue, especially if you're, if you were raised on a steady diet of Sorkin, you know what I mean? But like Sorkin is one of those people that is able to show via dialogue. He shows while he tells. There's a few great examples of this. One of which is The Matrix. There's a lot of showing, I
Not
mean,
written by Aaron Sorkin. He
not
showed.
written by Aaron Sorkin, but right. But there were, there's a lot of really great telling while by showing, or showing by telling in The
Yeah.
Matrix. When, the most famous scene is the scene where Morpheus is explaining to Neo what the Matrix is, like inside that white room. They do that thing, or the scene where the two of them have the kung fu fight.
Yes.
Like,
But I think in both of them, this is a scene, those are both scenes where we need a lot of exposition, right? We need it. But the Wachowskis are very smart and very skilled, and they knew if we're going to have this moment where we have to sit and listen to a character talk, we need to be make it very exciting. Let's stick us in a white room in the Matrix where both basically we're told we exist in an alternate reality, we exist in virtual reality and we're really, ba 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 ba. And then we see it too. Everything Morpheus says, then we get to see it actually happen as well. So that pays it off too. And then that fight, kung fu fight scene, oh my gosh, it's so exciting, right? Because along the way, it's not just we're having a kung fu fight scene, it's you should be better than this if you're the one, right?
Well, not only
How am I
that,
beating you? Yeah.
it's also like, Neo starts off, he's very confident, you know what I mean? He's like, he's got this whole
He says that
thing.
line, I know Kung Fu. Yeah.
He's like, he comes in, he's very confident in his new skills. And then he comes in, and then Morpheus just whoops the shit out of him. And he's just like, how the fuck is he doing this? You know what I mean? How is he so fast?
Yeah.
And it's also a reference to like, all of these older Kung Fu movies and stuff like that. But it has this, then Morpheus comes in and he just starts talking. He's like, how did I beat you? You know what I mean? They have like this school lesson in the middle of this fight. It's
Right. And so, yeah, they're having a conversation, but they're also doing kung fu. So it's a very exciting scene. They could have instead been like, we downloaded a great debate app, and now you're the greatest orator, and we'll hear you argue for the points of a free society. Instead, they downloaded, a skill app that has something to do with kung fu. So now they're moving all around the scene, having discussion of, well, why aren't you the greatest learner ever?
And then, but the audience also wants to know, they're like, how did he beat him? Like, you know what I
Yeah,
mean? Like,
Morbius is
what?
really good.
Right. He's so good. Why is he? You know what I mean? Is it because it's just better? Like, if they both have the same skills, you're thinking from a program, like, what is it? You know what I mean? It's a thing. So it's really, and then it becomes that they bring up, they're just like, you've got to free your mind. Your
Right.
mind, you're still stuck in
In the
what you
Matrix.
know,
Yeah.
right? You're still reverting back to those things. You gotta open up, bro. You gotta move past that. Like,
And
if you
trust the
want to get to this
process.
thing, you know what I mean? So those are great examples where you're getting showing by telling. But we're talking about boss kind of like, like top level kind of things.
Yeah, and I think it's easy to be. I always find that really annoying when you start screenwriting and you read a book and they're like, just do what Chinatown does and subvert all expectations. And you're like, what? Yeah, I'm like, okay, I mean, yes, I want to do that because that sounds really cool, but like, how do I begin and end a scene? Like, let's just work on the smaller lessons. So I think one of the things that I get from, I read a lot of amateur scripts for contests and stuff, and it always comes up, you know, a lot of a dialogue kind of as a band-aid for the plot where the characters are like, oh, I realize I need to put this part in there, but I didn't, I don't. Sometimes this is how I often hear it come across as someone's like, well, I didn't have the space, so I just made them talk about it real quick, or you know, I wasn't sure what that scene would have looked like, or you know, I just realized this happened, so I just threw it in there real quick as dialogue. You know, so nobody's sitting there going, I'm only gonna tell, I'm never gonna show. Usually it's like I'm in a pinch, I don't know exactly, or I don't think I can write the scene that I might show. I'm gonna cover it with this little, usually I call it the band-aid of dialogue. And that's, you know, maybe will suffice for a draft or two if you're trying to get your script up and running, but you will get to a point where professionally everyone's going to pull off those band-aids real quick and go, what's this? They don't stay on, and in fact it becomes painfully obvious they're there. And so just know if you're running into that that's something you're going to have to change. And I think one of the things people always, when I give them notes on that, they go, wait, I still can tell some things, right? Like, you know, I don't have to show everything. And I'm here to be like really nasty and say, this is a movie, not a novel. So you have to show everything.
You
You
have
know,
to.
and there are movies that get away with some exposition that's more tell. I think they're weaker for it. There are some filmmakers who do it more. I don't think that is not why they've made it. So like you may see somebody, I think of Chris Nolan does a lot of tell, but I'm gonna say if Chris Nolan wasn't the filmmaker that he is and the director that he is, those band-aids of telling would be more prominent and they would definitely bother people more. So if you're Chris Nolan and you're like, I got a system and sometimes I tell, fine. But if you're a new writer, especially or a filmmaker, you're probably going to run into those and they're going to be a problem for you. I'm not here to shit on Chris Nolan. I hear he's a lovely person. We just have a different approach.
Well, I mean, there's different Chris Nolan, because you're thinking like, if you're talking about Memento Chris Nolan, or if you're talking about
Oh.
Inception Chris Nolan, you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of show in Inception. You know what I mean?
There is, but there's also a lot of tell.
There is, but it's beautiful tell. I think, you know what I mean? There's
Yeah.
a lot of stuff in there. Like, there it's very cut. It's cut in a way, and it's like this in the script too, where they're moving and they're giving you like a the, there's a lot of movement around and sort of showing these are professionals doing what they do, and they give you
Sure.
the Ellen Page character so you don't get lost, because she's learning it too. So
Yes.
that's a very good example of how to do show don't tell, where you show this thing, you have to explain it anyway, so you have to do it. Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark does this also. When they're explaining about the Holy Grail, they have these folks from the government come in, and they're just like, what is this thing that Hitler is looking for? They have no idea, but Indy's a professor, so he gives them like a class course. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's ways to do it.
Yeah, and this, go on.
I think the best way that I've seen that is terms of show don't tell. The best example that I can give is the Mr. DNA sequence from Jurassic Park. Absolutely the best sequence. Because there was a thing that they had a big problem where they were trying to figure out how they were going to do all this exposition of how they made dinosaurs and make it fun. And so they were just like, what if we turned it into a theme park ride? You know what I mean? Like, it's like the Hershey ride at Hershey Park where they tell you how they
We'll
make
just
the
show you how
stuff.
the chocolate's made
Right.
real
And
quick.
so they do it literally by a thing. But here's one that I saw recently, and I think it will actually is at most applicable to our listeners. I was watching this video essay on Constantine, and it said the way that Constantine gets away with its pace, with not being really bogged down by the exposition of its world building, is they treat Constantine as if it is the sequel to a movie that does not exist. And so all of the characters react to each other in ways that they have very established, it's like that,
Relationships, yeah.
yeah, the very established relationships already. Like and occasionally there's clunkers, there's a few things in there that sort of feel exposition-y. No movie is perfect, but for the most part, they'll just have lines like, which way is east? And you're like, oh, okay, in order to do this, you have to be facing east. Like, you've got to keep up. You know what I mean? Like, it allows the movie to move forward without just saying that, things like that. Just the character shows their expertise by just, and then we just have to follow along. One of the characters asked, like, do you have, isn't it supposed, if you're doing a spell, shouldn't there be black candles and a pentagram and things like that? And he goes, why do you have any? You know what I mean? Like, what's the point of asking this question? Like, if you don't have it, what's the point? We're doing what we have. You know what I mean? So get rid of all that other kind of crap. Just treating the movie as if the characters already have some sort of, have had some sort of interaction before, knowing intently their relationships. And forcing the audience to hone in on the subtext of the characters. That's a way for you to get in a lot of exposition without being explicit about it in terms of character histories, what the world is like, what people are like within this world, what are their roles within that world. That opening scene in Constantine, where you have him going through and just like testing out which one of the symbols is going to work on the demon. We don't need to know why they work, but we know that they do work and that he's a professional. He's exercised enough demons to have a like a key ring of symbols that hurt them. You know what I mean? Like we know that this is his job. This is what he does. And that would there would be a reason why you will call this guy to exorcise a demon. There's an absolute reason for this because he's fucking good at what he does. He knows he's been through the things. And that's the I think that's the genuine way because it's you have to sort of treat your scenes as if they're being seen by a friend of yours who's never met your group of friends.
I'm gonna argue this is, I think, one of the biggest places we see telling versus showing is in these character introductions. Like coming in and having Constantine already have his tools to counteract demons,
Right.
already have a system, go in and know what he's doing. We walk out after meeting him and go, that guy knows what he's doing. He is a professional. He is not a newbie trying this out. That's a different character. I'm gonna pull another Keanu and say, John Wick does an excellent job of this as well. Because when we meet him, he's retired and he's sad his wife died and whatnot. But what it does is all the other characters start talking about, oh my God, did you just kill John Wick's dog? Right?
Right.
And it starts traveling through these crime ring syndicates and people, and they're like, wait, fucking John, wait, you did what to John Wick? And it builds this up that, like, number one, he isn't well known amongst these crime rings. They're afraid of him, and he's potentially one of the best like killers out there. And so by the time he gets there, it shows up and they're scared of him, even though we've just seen him be sad his wife is dead and his dog is dead. We are like, we're like, this guy is gonna kick some serious ass because we watched everyone else go, John Wick? Oh no. And so that tells us like this guy is a force.
Right. But even in that, there's like a really great piece of show don't tell where the bad guy of the movie calls John on the phone. And this is a man who clearly doesn't humble himself for anyone, but he calls John on the phone and just
To say
apologizes.
sorry. Yeah.
Right. He's like, I gotta go and apologize. I don't think it's gonna do anything, but I gotta do it just to see if I can avoid an all-out war. And like Keanu Reeves has no lines in this scene. You just listen to him, and the guy is hoping that he can get John to say anything. Anything.
Yeah, and
And
that
Keanu Reeves hangs up the phone. We're like, nope, he's not to be moved.
That none of that's gonna help. No,
Just
and it
hangs
does.
up the phone. It's
It
so
builds it up.
great.
It builds it up, and we're like, oh my gosh, like,
Yeah.
who
Oh my
is
God,
this
it's about
guy?
to go down.
It's
It's
about
going
to
to
go
go
down,
down.
and it builds that anticipation. And if this is one of the type of movies that didn't start him like doing a kick-ass fight scene or something like that, it takes a while. But the fact that everyone's so scared of what's going to happen if he starts fighting people, you build that anticipation too.
Right.
On the flip side, I would say if you're not an action person, you're not necessarily doing like a comic book character, I think Pixar is like the number one in show don't tell and setups. Like their act ones are banger. If you look at something like Wall-E, which uses little to no dialogue in it,
Yeah,
if you look at
just
something
fucking awesome.
like if you were to watch the first 15 minutes of Wall-E, you'd probably tell me everything that I needed to know about Wall-E, and nobody said anything.
Right.
And likewise, I think that
Up.
the montage of Up, you could have just said, you could have technically, story-wise, you could have seen him and his wife meet as kids and then cut to them, and now he's an old man and she's dead, and he could be like, oh, I miss my wife. But Pixar doesn't do that.
Nope.
No, Pixar shows their entire flipping life together and how they spent their life and how they hyper-focused on this trip to Argentina that never took place, and that even though it didn't happen, they loved each other and blah 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 blah. So by the time he's a Carl Fredrickson as an old man and a widow, we know everything we need to know about
Yeah,
him.
we are bereft. We are bereft as Carl is. You
Yeah.
know what I mean? Like we understand, like he's old and disgruntled and like crunchy, and you're just like, yeah, fuck that. Fuck
And
this world.
he never says that, like a blank line, like, oh, I just really miss my wife. No,
Not a thing.
no.
Yeah,
If
they
you see
just
him
let it
walk around the
go.
house, you see him talk like Ellie's still there, like, oh, we're not gonna put up with that, Ellie. And you're like, oh, buddy, like, and everything you're showing us, we're like, oh my gosh, you feel it 10 times more. And
Right.
then when he goes on this adventure and crazy fun stuff happens, it's wound us up because we know who this guy is through and through, and we know why he's basically gone crazy and is gonna fly his house to Argentina.
Right.
He doesn't explain it. Nobody along the way is like, why are you doing this? Nobody asks him. He never has to explain himself. Did you notice that?
Right. No,
Maybe
but yeah.
Russell at once, but I don't even think too much. Russell's more like, ah, I'm on the outside of the house. But we know where he's going because you showed us.
Right. So yeah, there's ways to do it.
I think it's cornering. What is it I need my audience to know,
Right.
right?
What do I need my audience to
And
know?
then
And
how can I show them that in an interesting way?
right. I think the opening in Little Miss Sunshine.
I use Little Miss Sunshine a lot to show people, like, show us a visual, important introduction to your character. And if you look at each of them, the opening of Little Miss Sunshine goes to each family member, and we see them doing something that's integral to their character. You open on all of the young girl watching a beauty pageant and imitating the wave of Miss America, and she's entranced. You open on Grandpa doing drugs in the bathroom. You have Steve Carell getting picked up from the hospital. He's trying to commit suicide. You have Paul Dano's character like doing push-ups and stuff in his room because he's trying to get into the Air Force. And you also have, oh man, Greg Kinnear has this great intro where we see him doing this big, motivational speaker presentation, and he looks big and powerful, and you cut away and there's only like six people in attendance. And like that tells you everything you need to know about these people. And so suddenly we saw these great intros, and now we put them at a dinner table together. We see how they interact, and then we know these things about them. We know all of when she gets the recording on the voicemail, that which is the inciting incident, that She was a runner-up for a pageant in California, and now she, because the previous winner got disqualified, is the new contestant. She has to get to the Little Miss Sunshine pageant if she wants her spot. And what does she do? She goes, and we know because you showed us the moment with Olive in the beginning is she's watching beauty pageants and she is transfixed. It's her world right now.
Right, 100%.
So
So,
anyway,
yeah,
I love Little Miss Sunshine.
I know
Sorry,
you do. I know. That's why I wrote it up. But
You put the
but,
catnip out and I snorted it
well, you
up.
know, that's a great segue into, you know, the one of the things, which is the best way, of course, to figure out how to do show don't tell is to look at great examples of show don't tell that we've talked about within this, you know, even within this podcast. You know, I feel like most of the movies that we've talked about, you can look up those screenplays. You can look up The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. You can look up Avengers Infinity War and Endgame. You can look up The Matrix. You can look up Little Miss
You can look
Sunshine.
up Wall-E, Little
Wall-E,
Miss
right.
Sunshine. Yeah,
You can follow
I'm
you.
trying to cross all the genres because it doesn't matter what the genre is.
Right.
I would
You
also argue sci-fi has to kind of balance out the most. So sci-fi is actually a really great place to look for too, because nobody wants to sit there and have everything explained to them, like why this doohickey works. Don't want. If you look at something like Ex Machina. They just get into it. They're like, there's this rich billionaire. You're going to go visit him, and he's got a robot he wants you to test out.
I've
That's
read
it.
that script and it
Yeah.
takes off like a fucking rocket.
It
Like
does.
it's fucking amazing. There's this great line of exposition where you're trying to sort of imagine the wealth and scope of this person. And Domhnall Gleeson's character goes, he goes, when are we going to be getting over the guy's like property? And he goes, and the pilot starts laughing. He's like, we've been over his property for like an hour.
Yeah, he's that remote and secluded. Yeah.
Right. He owns all of this. What you
Yeah.
were flying over, he owns it. You know what I mean? Like that's the kind of wealth that you're dealing with here, sir.
And it's such a good line, like from an Indian perspective, because they're just probably driving and helicoptering over some woods. But that's free set piece estate. Like they could have had to build this sprawling estate and this, that, and the other. And instead, it's just acres upon acres upon acres of trees. Naturally out there anyway, and saying like this is all of it, and it tells us how remote it is, and it tells us how rich he is.
Right, exactly. That's just, it's doing a lot of work with two lines.
Yes.
Like, when are we gonna get there? We're already there. Look at it. Like you're looking at it. Anyway, so you
Yeah,
wanted
so
to put some examples of tips that things that we use personally in our work.
I think it would be a good idea because, again, I think the thing that drives me nuts when I read a screenwriting book and they say, like, just go write Chinatown. And you're like, ah, okay. There's some stuff in between maybe you're not explaining. And so
Right.
you and I are a little bit nuts and bolts. We're working every day. We're more like screenwriting mechanics in the fact that we can kind of get the car up and going. And I think that intermediary is helpful. So for me, on projects that I have done, I'm doing that Demon Cat one first, right? And I needed to set up the character's house sitting for her mom's friends, right? And it would be fine if, you don't want a character just walk in and be like, so I am house sitting for my mother's friends. So what I did is I wanted to do more than that. So first thing is while she's driving into the property, she's getting a text from her best friend who says, let's go out tonight. And she says, I can't. Via text, I'm house sitting, and her friend says, you suck. And she responds back, I know. So already, like, we know, okay, she's house sitting. The house she's arriving at is a house she's house sitting for. Also, her sense of steam is pretty low. And then when she's trying to get into the house, her mother calls her and is surprised and upset that she hasn't found the key that she was supposed to find and doesn't trust her daughter to take care of her friend's house. And so already we understand, like, she's house sitting for her mom's friends. We understand that her friends would rather that she be out partying, but she's not going. So I got that information in 5 pages, but I also got that everybody in her life bosses her around. And we got to set up the house while she's walking around it looking for the key. So I got so much done, and really it didn't take any telling, only showing, because I created situations where I'm like, I want to see the house because we just got there. So it'd be great if she can't find the key in the front and has to circle around the house so we so still see it. And then, ooh, the back door is mysteriously open. What's that about? We'll get into that later. So all of a sudden I've been able to coil all that up because I realized my objectives were I need to set up that she's house sitting for her mom's friends, and we need to see what this house is like before she gets into it. Because once we're inside, there is a creature in the house. We don't know yet. And so I needed those things going first. So it's really helpful to kind of set up what you need to establish and then find fun ways to do it.
Yeah, I am my secret sci-fi epic,
Oh.
which I it's a big movie. It's a really big movie. It's like, it would be one of those 80 to $100 million blockbusters, which I'd never be able to do. I've wanted to write it for years, since literally since I was a teenager. And I'm gearing up, hopefully, to write it at the end of this year. I think it'll be a nice sort of, I'm feeling adventurous this year with Dasher. But anyway, the opening of the film is one of my favorites of anything that because I have to introduce this world, and that it's in like one of those near future kind of things. So the first thing that I did is I wanted to show how people are living and what the environment is like. And so we're zooming in, but we're not really zooming in. The camera then gets ahead of a drone, and on the drone is written, "New York sanitation, air filtration. We breathe so that you breathe better." Like, so it tells you that there are machines cleaning the air,
Yeah.
like, so that because of the pollution in the air, there's things out there that we've invented that are literally have swirling through the air at all times. And from that, we go into this apartment and we meet our main character. And I wanted to ground him. Like, immediately he has to get up and go towards his goal. We show that he, again, he starts talking to his boss, and it's clear that he's been suspended from work, but his boss is in a thing. He's just like, he's being let out of the doghouse, basically, and he's giving his boss shit. And his boss is basically like, "Look, do you want to come back to work or not? That's it. Like, I don't want to hear your shit. Come back to work or don't." So he goes out, but he's been sleeping with this woman, and they're clearly at this part of their relationship where it's like, is this a hookup thing? Like, are we fuck buddies, or are we actually, like,
Something happening here.
right, exactly. And so he's trying to have this awkward conversation with her, she just starts belting out lyrics to this song, like this pop song. Like, it is sort of like encompasses what they're talking, what he's trying to say. And she starts singing the lyrics like out loud. And so he's like, okay. So she just sort of lets all of the air out of, like, she lets him off the hook. And she lets us know, by letting him know, that she understands what this is, that they're, that they have to define it, but they're not going to define it tonight. And so she starts singing the lyrics. So I had to write a song. So I just wrote a song. I was just like, all right, fuck it. Why not? Because it'll be better off that way. Just let the characters sing their problems. So for me, it was just funny because people do things like that. You know what I mean? Just sort of in awkward situations where you're just like, I don't want to, nobody wants to live in this. You know what I mean? So somebody makes a joke. So she uses the lyrics and stuff like that, lets him off the hook. And then later on, in order to continue this, she sends him the song. And the song introduces the AR-based world that they're living in, where everybody is wearing these contacts that allows you to see people's profiles. They have a profile for this, and you see what information is like available on the profile. And so from her profile comes that song, and it comes up and it starts playing. Like it's a whole thing. So you get
And
to
now it's
see
a
that.
motif. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So you get to see how these people live their lives and how, what their technology is like. And I used all of that with just by writing a song. So by doing all of that, I've set up the characters, I've set up where their relationship is, I set up where he's going. And then I waited till the character got on the roof and he tries to get into this transport that's been sent to him from his job, but he can't get in because his clearance has been revoked. And he's forced to call his boss and is like, hey, can you override this in order to let me in? We're like, oh, okay. So this is something that's serious because he literally had to call his boss to get an override to get into the thing that his work sent him. You know
Yeah.
what I mean? He's clearly in the doghouse. And so then you have this thing of them going through traffic and showing like there's these cars that like people are not driving the cars. They're air cars or they're flying and stuff like that. But you can see like all over, like people are being advertised to. The whole screens, they're just being advertised to. You can't like skip them. You know what I mean? People are just going through it and they're just getting all of these things bombarding them at all times. It just shows you what the technology, what the environment is like now that they're
Yeah.
into this sort of thing. And I had to, for me, is like that's all show.
Yeah, and I think this is a really good example of the type of thing you need to show in sci-fi, because especially in a sci-fi world, it's a world that is potentially the future, dystopian otherwise, and even if it's just the light future, or I call it the future 5 minutes from now,
Right.
you still have to show us what's different or what has advanced, because if not, we won't know it's different than present day. And or you know, that's when you get into stuff like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is like, this is sci-fi, but it's happening right now in
Right.
the regular world. You know, and these things are important for us to know. Are there fly is it flying cars sci-fi, or is it Charlie Kaufman, Let Me Erase Your Memory sci-fi, while people dance over your sleeping body?
Yeah. I love the line in Eternal Sunshine where they say, like, Joel's character says, is there any risk of brain damage? And Mira's way it goes, technically the procedure is brain damage.
I mean, yeah, it would be.
Yeah, right. You know, like technically it is, but it's on a par with a night of heavy drinking. You know what I mean? They immediately quantify it.
Yeah.
So you're like, oh, okay. You know what I mean? That's showing, not telling. I mean, that's telling while showing.
Yeah, and you're telling us with a joke. And that's why I said, if you use exposition and you use humor in it, we're less likely to kind of be caught off guard. And also, again, we're having one character who doesn't know ask the expert question. So it's a naturally set up dynamic. We see this exposition all the time when there's a first character who's like new on the job. You mentioned Ellen, then Ellen, now Elliot Page in Inception. And you know, Harry Potter is a classic example of it. Harry Potter, the first Harry Potter, walks through and he's never been around magic. So he's constantly being like, Hagrid, what's that? What's that? What's that? And it makes sense because that dude grew up in a bed under a staircase in the regular world. So he's not going to know what any of this stuff is. And so we buy it. It's natural. Another exposition I enjoy, and this one comes straight from Save the Cat. So I'm so sorry. I think it's like Save the Cat 3. But he recommends this exposition that if you have to give us a lot of interesting information, or you have to give us information, then at least visually show us something interesting in the scene while we're getting it. He calls it, I don't know if you've heard of this one, called Pope in the Pool.
I have not.
Okay, so the idea is, imagine two people are sitting poolside and having a discussion, right? And we have to follow that information. And then the Pope gets to the pool side and jumps in his skivvies. We're all gonna go, oh my God, the Pope is in the pool. And although we're hearing the information, what we're visually seeing is so striking that we're captivated by the scene. And so this is kind of a good way to, you know, if you gotta get information out, at least show us some interesting stuff while we wait for the information. I think that's why the DNA ride works so well in Jurassic Park. We gotta get the information, but we stuck it in a ride, so it's exciting.
Yeah, it's really
There's a little
great. And
animated DNA guy. Yeah, things are happening.
but even still, at the end of that ride, when we have enough information to make us dangerous, what happens? The characters literally break the ride and jump off the ride.
Yes.
They leave. Like they're just like, all right, we're done. We're literally done with
We
this.
got it.
We got it.
Exactly.
We're good. And then they roll out and they're just like, okay. And so, you know, that scene is like, you know, just God tier in terms of exposition and being able to just like, you know, literally the one of the John Hammond is like participating in the whole thing. They do that thing where he like his fake John like pokes him. You know what I
Yeah, and
mean?
he's like, ouch, that hurt. Yeah.
Like a whole thing, it's like a whole routine. He's so happy to, and you're like, there's literally acting going on during this exposition. And I'm just like, they're just, and you don't, and that's the thing, you wouldn't think of the Mr. DNA sequence as exposition in itself because it's hidden. You're not thinking of it as like you're absorbing it. You're like, you're on the ride with them, you're learning what they're learning. And you're like, oh man, that's how they make the chocolate.
Yeah, and then they're
Okay.
all different reactions. You get, oh, I want to get off the ride, no big deal. We get the I'm happy because I've been working so long. I want to show everybody my ride. You know,
Right.
everybody's got a different attitude against the information they're learning as well. So you're getting character development in there as well. The story did not stop through the exposition.
Right.
It folded it in, and we're still experiencing the story while the exposition's happening. And that, I think, is ultimately where exposition goes south. Because a lot of people are like, ooh, I'm against all exposition. No, a lot of stories require you need some exposition to understand what's going on. You just want to fold it in there so it's not like we're getting pulled out and then pushed back in again.
Right, the movie doesn't come to a full and complete stop while you're getting this information. That's what makes that, you're right. That's the difference between good exposition and exposition where you're like,
Yeah.
you're just, you know, you're like, and especially if you have a bunch of those scenes in a row where you're like going forward and you're just like, I can't even. That one of the best where it's there, I think. My favorite, I don't know, maybe probably my favorite is Steve Jobs, where they use basically exposition as action scenes. Like the second act is essentially one giant exposition dump of what happened between the first scene and the last scene.
Yeah.
And just like, you know, goes on because Steve is in, he's in his failure at this point. So we're getting up to it, and they go back and forth between Fassbender and Jeff Daniels' character, and they're going back and forth, but it's the most exciting exposition you've ever heard. And they're just cutting back and forth in time and moving and weaving and bobbing. You're just like, oh my God. At the end of it, you're literally dizzy. And you're just like, oh, whoa. And it wasn't like anybody was swinging at each other, but it feels like you just got off a roller coaster.
Yeah, it absolutely does.
So there's ways that there's a lot of ways to skin this cat, if not save it. So let's move on to what are we watching, consuming, and writing this week. What about you, Kate Tucker? What are you watching, consuming, writing?
Yeah, so I said last week, my partner is really excited to go back to the movie theaters. So we watch Argylle in theaters, and it is ridiculously silly and funny. So I enjoyed it. We're watching a Hulu mystery series, Death and Other Details, with Mandy Patinkin in it, which is interesting. I'm curious to see how it all comes together. You know, it made it come across a little bit more like a comedy, but it's a little bit more just like a stylized, colorful mystery. So don't be too deceived by the kind of like the brightness of it. And also it's got Lauren Patton in it, who I love. She was in got a Tony for Jagged Little Pill, where she played Jo. And so naturally I'm a Laura Patton stan. So it was good to see her. And I hope she gets more work in film as well. So there you go. Oh, and then the other thing is I'm working on my Monkey Paw application right now, and I am turning Feed
You and
Feed
everybody
Feed.
else.
Me and everybody else, I'm turning Feed 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 into a short, or a version of it into a short cast. It will work as a proof of concept for the feature, but it needs to be its own standalone short. So I'm just making some changes in it, because it's going to be about 12 pages.
Fantastic. Well, I meant to talk about this last week. I watched Players for Valentine's Day. The wife and I, we went and we had a really nice dinner, and then we came home and we were, because one of her favorite actresses is Gina Rodriguez, who is in that film. And she's one of my wife's favorite actors from the show that's like the Jane the Virgin. Jane the Virgin is one of her favorite shows. And for me, I was very much into Damon Wayans Jr. I love Damon Wayans Jr. So it was two of our favorite people in a thing. And then Tom Ellis is also there. He's pretty cool. I really enjoyed the film. I love rom-coms, and I think this one was one I was watching it, and it's about these folks who run like scams. Like, they run like a series of cons, but for hooking up. So they're like a crew of like thieves, but they do like they have all these names for different sort of cons that they run. If they run into somebody at a bar that they're interested in, and they run whatever con that they need in order to get them, and Gina Rodriguez, she plays as the leader of the group. She sort of decides which play they're gonna run, and it's a really interesting premise, and I really, really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed the message of it. I think it's well written. I was watching this and I was like, I would watch this in a theater. I was really upset that it wasn't in a theater. It's one of the best Netflix movies that I've seen in quite a while. It's funny. I laughed all the way through. I captivated by it. I really, really missed not seeing it in a theater. And I hadn't felt that way about a Netflix movie in a while. And so I really enjoyed that film. And I wanted to, yeah, I forgot to mention it last week, but I think everyone should watch it. We're kind of through Valentine's Day, but if you're looking for a movie to sit down and watch with your sweetie on Saturday night, just sort of cuddle up and watch a rom-com, I recommend Players very highly. So I was into that. I've been back on my Bones kick after taking a break to sort of, I'm doing alternating weeks. And 1 week I'm doing Bones, the next week I'm doing Only Murderers in the Building. And so I'm doing Bones this week. And I love this thing in terms of writers where you're watching a writer come up through the ranks, or you notice that the same writer writes all of your favorite episodes of a show. And that writer is Noah Hawley on Bones. And yeah, and I didn't know that that seems to be where he got his sort of biggest boost to his career. And he very much he's one of those writers that you could tell just was like someone has emerged as a star of this writer's room. And they're just like, no, that episode, give it to Noah. And he just seems to be that guy for the show. And so I ended up looking him up because I know that he's done Fargo, and he did that show Legion for FX. But he also is a novelist. So I did not know that. So I will be reading his book Anthem coming up. So because I'm officially on my grind on Dasher. I wrote a lot this week. I am
Good.
I wrote
The floodgates opened.
the floodgates open for real. And so I'm very far into chapter three. I am introducing the Watson to my Sherlock, the very fun AC, who is the main character's his ex-wife's new girlfriend. And so the two of them, they start out, of course, they can't stand each other. And so we meet her via text. So it was fun for like to write her opening scene as a text message battle between the two of them. And then I figured out a bunch of stuff this week. I was like, I don't know how long this lasts. Because I not necessarily that I need a ticking clock, but I also finished rereading Janet Ivanovich's One for the Money this week. And I realized how she very much sort of navigates the stakes of Stephanie trying to navigate this new world of being a bounty hunter and having no money and comes basically starting from the bottom, that sort of thing. And it was very inspirational, I think, for Dasher. So I was going through and sort of figuring out, like, how I could use parallels and things like that. But introducing this character via text message and seeing, just sort of showing what relationship that these characters already have, sort of doing that showing, don't telling on in via text message, and being able to figure out, I figured out how the movie is going to end. I don't know how exactly, but I know that it has to end a certain way. And then I also was able to put a ceiling on it. Like, I was like, oh, okay, well, I know how long this now has to last, because it sort of, like, I was already there, but I just used the framing device of a person counting down towards rent gives it stakes.
Yeah.
So, and if you're dashing, you're living that life of, like, I need, you're counting down that the money that you need towards the thing that you are trying to pay for. That's what dashing is pretty much about. And so for this, it's about the rent, and he's got a certain number of money, a certain number of time in order to get it. And of course, he starts off with a perfect amount of time with what his goals are to be able to dash enough to make rent with time to spare. So of course, we start in that position, and
And
then it
then
gets worse.
complications ensue.
Right. So I'm very much into it. I finally wrote my first scene that of the book where I can't wait for someone to read it. It shows up in chapter three. There's a really great scene, and I realized I was doing a kind of parallel narrative that I didn't realize I was doing until I got to that scene. I was like, oh, I'm doing that. So, but it was the
That's fun.
first, yeah. But I was like, oh, I can't wait for someone to read this scene and be like, oh, it's, the book is cooking. I'm liking
Good,
it. I'm
good.
digging it.
Happy to hear that. So, Rob, what's our resource of the week?
Well, we've done this before when dealing with one of the core conceits of screenwriting. We did it for the second act, the third act, for the midpoint. So, and as we always say, we are not the only voices, obviously, on this subject. So we have compiled, once again, a YouTube playlist of videos for you guys to chew on and, have some further thoughts on today's topic. So, we're going to give you some that say you should tell, not show. There's going to be stuff that say that is firmly show, don't tell. So it'll be nice for you guys to, have some differing opinions. I hope you guys get into it.
And that's our show. Screenwriting from the Trenches can currently be found on Amazon, Anchor, Apple, Google, iHeartRadio, and Spotify podcasts, as well as KevinLMartin.com. Our screenwriting Twitter drama theme song was written by Zach Morrison and used with his permission. And hey, since we'd appreciate it if you dropped us a like or rated us 5 stars on whatever platform you patronize. Why, Rob Higgins?
Algorithms.
For questions that for us that we can and will answer on the show, you gotta email rob@bmofo.net. You can also find us on the Twitters. Rob, where are you on Twitter?
I'm at Respectable Mofo.
I am at K_Tux, and Zach is at ZachMorrison18. These things, as well as Rob's YouTube channel, where the Cinnamon Challenge series is alive and well, on how to make a movie for $1,000, will be linked in the show notes. How is the Cinnamon Challenge series going?
It's going. It's getting back on its feet. We had, I think we just needed some time to post finishing Sex Like Pizza in order to just sort of get our ducks back in a row, and for me to get on board with Dasher, and also for us to figure out what we're doing next in order to sort of, take all that and show where we're going. But we've been doing that, and we're ready to go. We should be ready to put up some new stuff by March. We should be putting up some new, some, we'll be back on our grind.
Nice. Glad to hear it. So check that out as well. We'll make announcements when more content is up there. And thanks so much for listening. We hope you continue to do so.
And now you guys need to stop procrastinating. I mean, come on, these pages, they're not going to write themselves.